Hello, everybody. This is a recording from the consultation lesson of the eighth practical, sorry, of the eighth lecture of the deep learning course. What we will, or what is being recorded, is the description of the rest of the assignments, which I didn't finish on the practicals, which are the last two Tegger assignments, the Tegger CLE, and Tegger competition. And then I would also like to talk a bit about the running SVHN competition. So we finished talking about the Tegger VE, WE, I should probably say the Tegger WE on the practicals. So there are two more assignments which follow this Tegger WE. The first is the Tegger CLE. The problem with the Tegger WE is that it cannot reasonably represent so-called unknown words. If some word is missing from the in the training data, the embedding in the embedding matrix won't be created for it, so it will not be representable by the neural network. And we discussed a solution to that on the lecture, which was to also be able to compute the representation of a word or infer the representation of the word by using its characters, by really sequentially processing the characters. So we are in the following situation. We have the input, I don't know, like deep learning. We use this embedding matrix. Maybe there is we here. There is definitely deep learning somewhere. And we use that, right? We get the embedding. So in fact, at this point, if we have a full batch, we have like a three-dimensional tensor. Right, this is the batch size, this is the sentence length, and this is the embedding dimensionality. So that's what we get after embedding the words. If some word is not present in the dictionary, there is this specific unknown entry which has ID 0, so all unknown words are actually mapped to this embedding. This embedding was not used during training at all, because all the words were used during training. So it's like a randomly initialized embedding, and the network will do something. But nothing probably terribly good. So in order to improve, we will also consider the so-called character level word embedding. So apart from this dictionary approach, we will do some magic black box, which will get the individual words. So we will put in we, like deep learning. It will process them somehow, and then it will generate the representations in a similar tensor as on this side. Maybe they should be of a similar size. So let me draw it larger. And so here is batch size, here is sentence length, and here is some embedding dimension, but not necessarily of the same size as from the dictionary. So let me draw this in another color. Yeah. So once we have both these representations, the dictionary-like and the other one, like character-like, what we will do is that we will concatenate them, right? So we will do this, then concatenate this other representation, right? And then we will process this in the same way as we did in the Tegger WE. And what is new is now we have like more complex representation, not just the dictionary-based one, but also some kind of a character-based one. And what we need to do is we just need to describe this part. right? So let me open it in another window. So we have got this, we, like, I don't know how many E's did I had, three, deep learning. Maybe deep learning is great, the second sentence. And now we need to represent birds. So what we will do generally is we will use a recurrent approach again. So we will consider the individual characters of the word. For example, there it is, like E. Right. We will embed each character. We will use a bi-directional, well, I explicitly use GRU so that we don't have to specify it on the command line. So we use explicitly these bi-directional RNNs. We are only interested in the whole sequence representation, so just the last output, not the intermittent ones. Then we will concatenate those two representations, and that's what we will use for our character level word embeddings. However, it can easily happen that some birds are repeated in the whole batch, and it is quite wasteful to compute the character level word embeddings for even the repeated words in the batch. And even if it sounds that, like, repeated words, well, that's not really, like, frequent enough, then it is frequent enough, because we have got, like, the determiners, like the, or verbs like is, or full stops. Like, all of these words are usually part of any sentence. So actually, like, mentioning this fact or using this fact that they are, the words are present multiple times on the input, definitely makes sense. So the general approach will be, I will just find it. Okay, so it's in other slides. So the general approach will be as follows. During training, we will not compute the character level of word embeddings for all the words in the batch, but only for the unique words in the batch, right? The embedding doesn't depend on context, it's just the word itself. So first we will find the unique words, then we will compute the embeddings of the unique words, and then we will, like, copy the resulting embeddings to the corresponding slots, right? So it's not just like this, that for each word I will run the computation, but in fact, I will start by creating a unique list of words in the batch, right? We, like, deep learning, which is there twice, is great. This means we will actually get, like, a two-dimensional sequence, two-dimensional list of characters. So the shape of that will be, like the batch, the shape will be like number of unique words, and here will be the maximum word length. Right. Then we will do the RNNs completely in a analogous way as during the computation of the word representations. See character level embeddings via GRU specifically in this task. And then we will again, like, expand the results into this original shape. So that's the plan. Let's now have a look at the template which describes the process. The template is a continuation of the Tagger WE. So there are to-do nodes, and many of the to-do nodes have this Tagger WE written there, right? So these are completely identical to the Tagger WE. So once you do Tagger WE, you can easily copy the solutions from them, right? So actually, everything is the same as in the Tagger WE. The only difference is that there is a large list of instructions here, which is the computation of the character level embeddings. So first, we have this rect tensor. So what we do is we first use just the values, which means we just ignore the indices and just take the tensor, which contains all the words on the input. And we will pass this like flattened list of words through tf.unique. And the tf.unique deals with the duplicates in the input. It only works on a one-dimensional input, which is one of the reasons why we are flattening our words. And what it does, well, it obtains or returns a list of unique words, and also it generates the indices of what unique word is actually some word on the input. TF values is an attribute of the rect tensor, like the words are rect tensor, which is internally represented as two vectors or two tensors. One are like the flattened values without the holes, and the other are the indices. I probably have it somewhere here. Yeah. So let's say that we have got this tensor with these three sentences, some of the lengths. So this rect tensor is internally represented as two tensors, like non-rect. First, the list of all elements without the paddings, and then a list of indices, which tells us where are like the borders or the boundaries in this list. Right, so you know that, for example, the third sentence is represented from indices 6 to index 9. So that's what the values is. The values from this rect tensor gives you this flattened list of elements. Yeah. The TF unique does. This first, it really returns the list of all the unique elements. So let's say that I've got words A, B, A, C, something like this, and we get two outputs. One output is actually the tensor with the unique elements, so that's just A, B, and C. And then we get these indices, which tells us that the first word is actually the one on index 0 in the unique list. The second word is actually on index 1 in this unique list. This third word is on index 0 in this unique list, right? So you then know by which word is each word on the input represented. That's exactly what we need. So great, we get this list of unique words. So we have point one is done. Now we can really run the RNN. So we start by generating the individual characters. So we have got strings and we want to expand them, split them for individual characters. For that, we can use tf.strings.unicodesplit, and we need to specify the encoding, which is UTF-8. So now, maybe let me track the sizes, right? So the unique words have like number of unique words. Now we do the split and we get number of unique words. I should have selected something shorter, and maximum word length, right? Because now each word is actually a tensor, like a sequence of characters. So it was a tensor. Now it is again a rect tensor, right? Because the individual elements have different lengths. So we have got characters. We need now to process the characters. So instead of the string characters, we really get IDs from the char mapping, or character mapping, probably it's better to explain. So the other strings to IDs. Right, means we still have the same shape, but this time it's no longer strings, but IDs. Then it will be similar to the previous approach. So we embed the characters, which means our shape expands to a number of unique words. Well, this max word length, it's like the maximum one. Well, in fact, this is like unknown, but the maximum value is the maximum length of the word. And then there is this CLE dimensionality of the embedding, which is a value specified on the command line. Now we use a bi-directional GRU, which generates only the sequence representations. So what we get is we get something which has the size of the number of the unique words. And for each word, we have the concatenation of the forward and the backward result of the RNN. So it's 2 times CLE dim, right? Forward and backward. And these are the representations of the words which we wanted to compute. And now we need to get back to the original rect tensor, right? So first we need to undo the uniquing, right? So in order to undo this, we use the tf.gather, right? tf.gather is just the indexing operation. So for example, here, when we have this unique, so it was like a unique word index, right? So I've got the unique words, I've got the unique word indices. And you can say tf.gather like index the unique words by the unique word indices, and you recover the original sequence. Right, so that's what we do. We undo this uniquing, and we get still a flattened list, but now it's number of words, not number of unique words. And then we take this flattened representation and generate back the rect tensor with the same shape as the original rect tensor. Right, so we got from this 2D representation to 1D. Now we have generated the representation, so we want to go back. In order to go back, we can use the fact that every rect tensor has a method called with values, which creates like a new rect tensor, which gets just the flat values and copies the structure of the method of the tensor which it's being called on. Right, so after calling words with values, we get a rect tensor. And the shape is as input words. Woohoo! So that's exactly what we needed. We now just concatenate the word level and the computed character level embeddings, and we are done. So let's have a look at some results. So if we I will probably include the training data as well. Yes, if there are any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. Yep, I'm sorry, it doesn't seem to be working correctly. That sometimes happens. If you delete the logs, then sometimes it takes a bit longer for TensorBoard to realize that they've deleted something. So let me show you what I want. That should be this and this. No, so this and this. Oh, I think it should be this. I'm sorry, I was running some experiments here and I've kind of, oh, I know what's happened now. So let's do it like this. So these are the accuracies computed on the train set and on the test set in this Stagger WE assignment. We only use 5,000 sequences, sentences, so that the training is reasonably fast, but it also means that we don't really use that much data. On the training set, you see that we approach 100% accuracy, while on the development set, well, we are somewhere like 0.86, 0.82, and we are not really improving because our dictionary is constructed just out of 5,000 sentences, which is definitely too little. Now, if we, or when we add the correct level embeddings, yes, these are the results on the default settings. Once we add the correct level embeddings, you see that we have gone from this gray curve to the blue one. So we are substantially better because we can now tell at least something for every input verb. However, there is still a big like deficiency or discrepancy in the way how we train things. And the problem is that during inference, these unknown verbs, they just like take this randomly initialized embedding, which is kind of bad because the network cannot really understand that it should now rely more on the correct level embedding. So that's one problem. The other problem is that during training, all the words are present in the dictionary. All the training words are present in the dictionary. So when the gradient flows, it's usually slightly easier for the gradient to flow into the embeddings. So instead of like perfectly training the correct level embeddings, the words can be explained just by their corresponding word embeddings. So this part, this correct level embedding part, doesn't need to do much. So in order to improve both of these situations, we will add another method, which you can consider like to be like a dropout on words. Like it's usually not called like this. It's usually called something like word masking, or you can hear even word dropout, but that usually has a different meaning. So what we are doing is we are word masking words. And this means that with some random probability, we replace each word by this specific unknown word index, right? So randomly for each word, we say, okay, we don't know this word. Right, it's an unknown word, which means we will use this unknown word embedding for it, which is great because then we will train it, so we will actually have an embedding for an unknown word. And also, this embedding will not be enough to explain the word, right? So that will motivate the network to actually train the character level embedding part more so that it really needs to explain this word, because we cannot rely on the word embedding part because we have deliberately not used it for this specific instance. So that's the last thing which we need to do in the assignment, and that will be relatively straightforward, or the description is straightforward. So once we have mapped the words to indices, what we need to do is for each word with the probability of word masking, we want to replace the input word ID by the ID of the unknown word, which will be zero, right? We need to do this before embedding the word. This is not really dropout in a sense that the word would get all zeros. No, the ID of the word will be changed to zero, so it will get the embedding of the unknown word. Unfortunately, it's a bit tricky because what we want to do is we in fact want to use dropout in a sense, but the dropout does two things. Not only it sets the elements to zeros, but it also scales the remaining ones, right? We talked about it at the beginning that we need to increase the value of like the surviving values so that they have the same variances as without them. But we have indices like integers on input, integral values. So we cannot scale them by 0.2 or something, and the layer will object like, oh, I cannot process like non-floating values. But still, the dropout layer has a lot of functionality. It changes whether you are using that in training mode or not. If you wanted to implement this manually, which you could, you would need to switch your behavior depending on whether we are training or not. So in this case, let's be hacky and actually use the dropout layer. So what we will do is we will create like a tensor of ones, of like floating point numbers of all ones, just so that it can receive the masks, such that we know which of them were thrown away by the dropout. So we create these ones, we pass them through the dropout layer with a given rate. And that will give us a result where some of the elements will be masked, so they will be zero, and the other will have some non-zero value, like slightly larger than one. And we can use this mask, we can use this result to know where to put zeros in our input, right? So I agree that maybe implemented from scratch would be a bit cleaner, but this is something like two lines, which does neatly what we want. So it's a hack. But it's working. So if we do it, we can have a look at the results. We will see that during training, that's the red line, the results are worse. That definitely makes sense because during training, we deliberately don't see 10% of words. The word dropout is set to 10% at this point. However, during inference, that this light blue curve, you see that the results are slightly better than the dark blue curve because we have reasonably trained unknown embedding and we are forcing the correct level embeddings to be trained to the fullest to contain all the information about the verb, because otherwise the correct level embeddings can just say, okay, I leave everything to the verb embeddings, right? But if you like disallow the verb embeddings to use the embeddings all the time, then correct level embeddings need to supply their role. So that's the Tegger CL. It's in the end, it's not much code. It's really several lines, but the whole like reason why we are doing them is a bit long. So that's the reason why I talked so long about it. The next one will be faster. Now, once we have the correct level embeddings and word embeddings, we can do a competition, and the competition will be a Tegger competition where you can extend the CLE into a real world a part of speech Tegger. We will use much larger data set, which can still be loaded by the Morpho dataset module. However, it has very fine grained hierarchy of part of speech tags, so there are really many of them. As you see, it's more than 1,500. So, for example, it might look like this. So there is like maybe this line. It says okay, there is verb Rychlejší. The lemma is Rychlý, and this is the part of speech tag. It says it's an adjective. It's in the singular number. It's a feminine verb. It's in the first case. It's the second degree. That the second word to a second degree of the positive form, right? So there are a lot of these informations, not just actually a part of speech tags. So there are many of them. These post tags, they have fixed structure. So in theory, you can predict the individual positions independently, but usually people just predict the whole tag as one class. Also note that the PDT dataset is quite large, so the train set is something like 1.6 million words, so doing a single epoch might take a while. You have some additional resources which you can use in this assignment. First, you can use the outputs of a morphological analyzer. What does this mean? Is that we also have a dictionary, and the dictionary can give us all possible part of speech tags and all possible lemmas for any word present in the PDT data. So what you get is you can get data like this. So for example, like for each form here for this sub, these analyses, they contain all possible pairs of lemma and tag. So this form has two analyses. It has same lemma in both analyses, but different tags. Once in the second case and once in the fourth case. So you get this data and you might or might not use them. Specifically during inference, then maybe it makes sense to respect this dictionary and only generate the analyses which are present there, right? What we try to do is that if there is a word in this dictionary, then all existing lemma and part of speech tags are there in the dictionary, right? So if you find a word there, then hopefully all possible analyses are there and you can reasonably surely rely on using one of those. You can also use any unannotated text data. Right. Whatever just plain text you use, you can, no problem. And it's a usual competition task. So you just submit the text file, which is just a form lemma tag triples, likely just the predicted part of speech tags. I still didn't publish the template. I'm still finalizing it, but it will be published today. By the way, there is a specific competition here. The pre-neural network state-of-the-art result was 95.89, so nearly 96%. So anybody who surpasses this result will get 3 additional bonus points. So in total, they'll probably get 8 because usually, well, each year everybody surpassed this value, if I remember correctly. So there are always 1, 2, 3, 4 people or teams who can pass this. So it's doable, and it will get you some additional bonus points. So this was the technical competition. The results on the development set and on the test set correlate very well with each other. The reason is that they are, or like reasonably well. Usually, when I get something like 98 on the development set, I get something like 97.7 on the test set. It's slightly lower because the test set contains texts which come more in the future, but the results correlate very well. So if you choose data with the highest development accuracy, then it's extremely likely that these will be also the ones with the highest test accuracy. A reason for that is just the sheer size of these development and test sets, because the development test contains something like 200,000 words. And similarly for the test set, right? So because they are extremely large, yep, they correlate well. Yep. If you want, I might update RecordX to indicate this, right? So if you want, I can add the output to the output of the of the record exchange to show that you passed not only the baseline, but also this state of the art. It doesn't cost me much. So if you are interested, I can do it. Woohoo! Yep, no problem. Yeah, by the way, like 2 years ago or something, the student who wrote the best tagger then wrote a paper about it and was accepted to a nice conference. So that was nice. But unfortunately, probably you won't be able to do it nowadays because it has already been published. So that are the new assignments. I probably also would like to tell you something a bit about the SVHN competition so that we have it somewhere on the record. I'm not trying to describe the best possible solution or something. I'm just trying to describe a simple baseline which you need to do in order at least get above these 20% intersection over union on the test set. So the baseline solution would probably be just like RetinaNet-like single stage detector. So we get the image, we try all possible positions for the anchors, and for each anchor we decide whether there is some object on it, and if there is, where exactly it is. So our architecture will look like this. Well, I probably don't have it anywhere. So I will instead draw the architecture. It will probably be better. So let's take the image, right, and pass it through EfficientNet. Out of the EfficientNet, we will take just a fixed size output. Yeah, we have images of various sizes, but the simplest approach is probably to scale them to a common size. Right, so I would just rescale them to 224 times 224, then pass them to EfficientNet and take one of these outputs, right? So this is some fixed height and fixed width. You can just, like in the easiest solution, you can just take one level. Of course, if you want better results, you should use some kind of these feature pyramids, but we are going with this single feature map approach. So we just when considering the levels, we can just take only one level and we will predict the results on that. I'm just saying that this is the simplest solution. Usually that's how you need to proceed. If you are doing something more difficult, this is more difficult assignment, you should start by creating something very simple which works, right? So that's definitely in the beginning a single level solution. Once you have a single level solution working, you can then try adding the various levels. But if you have a working baseline, you can debug much more effectively, because if it doesn't work, you know what code you actually changed. And then you can also see what the difference in the results will be, right? So I would definitely start with a single level. So now we got the features. So we have got something like the, I'm sorry, I wrote it incorrectly. So we have got height, width, and some number of channels. And now in the RetinaNet-like approach, what we will do is we will apply this classification double head, or how to say these two classification heads. One will try to predict the probabilities of classes for each anchor, and the other will predict the bounding boxes. So what we do is we try all possible centers, right? So we consider all possible regions in the image and we consider anchors centered at these coordinates. In theory, we can try multiple anchors. So we can try some number of anchors, but once again, usually that's like A anchors for each position. Usually at the beginning, I would just start with one. You need to choose like a reasonable size of the anchor so that it would be reasonably sized to the usual size of a digit. So if you look at the data set, you will see that the digits usually, I don't know, take something like 1/3 of the image. I'm not saying that they are not larger ones, But generally, what you could do is you could take the anchor, which will be, I don't know, something like one third of the image times one third of the image, or maybe one half of the image times one half of the image, something like that, right? If you want to start with something, like start with this single scale, but definitely this is a big discrepancy. Also, when you look at the boxes, they are usually taller than wider. So maybe the good idea is to actually respect that and say that you have a box which will be like one half of the image high, and it will be like times one fourth of the image to the width or something. Like you can even measure what are the best sizes so that you would cover the train set the best. It'd probably be more principled approach than me just guessing the constants from the data, but that's something what I would start with. Then you need to create the data for training. For that, we can use the BBoxes training. The BBoxes training needs to get the goal data, which you have, but it also needs to get the anchors. So how I am talking about all these choices is that now, once you have decided how many anchors you want to try for each position and what their size will be, you can actually generate the anchor net, right? So you will try all different inputs in this image. You need to realize like how large these anchors would be, or like were these positions mapped in the original image, right? And what size of the anchor you actually want to use or consider in the original in the original space or the original size. You can index the image by indices 0, 0 and 224 times 224, but it's probably slightly easier to say that this is 0 and this is 1. Like 0 is top left and 1, 1 is bottom right. Then the coordinates in this smaller image are the same as in this larger image, right? This is always, I don't know, like 20%. Of the image from left to right, so 0.2 and I don't know 0.1 from top to bottom, and these coordinates they hold independently on the size of the image, right? So once you have the coordinates in this, you also have the coordinates in this. So it's slightly simpler, but you can easily multiply them by the correct width and height if you want to. And so if you try all the centers and you know the sizes, you get this nice grid. This grid is something you need to pass to the BBoxes training. And the BBoxes training will generate you two outputs, the classes for each of these anchors, right? These anchors at this point, they are linearized. They probably don't have a two-dimensional structure anymore. They are just like 1D list of various anchors. For that list, you will get a list of classes, which will either be zero, or it will be non-zero, which means that there is actually some gold object allocated there. And you'll get the list of the same size, which contains the coordinates of the boxes on the corresponding region. And they are just zeros for where there is nothing interesting going on. But where there is an interesting object, you have the coordinates. So now you have the training data. The network will have this classification head and this bounding box head, and you will just use, so it will have two outputs, and you will just use these two data as the two golden data. That's why we did NIST multiple, so that you don't have to worry about networks and models with multiple inputs and outputs. The only difference is that during training, you actually don't want to train all possible bounding boxes, right? In this output, you only want to train these, but not these zeros and not these zeros, right? You only want to predict the positions of the real objects which are there. So only for the anchors for which there are some gold object. There is some gold object. For that, you can use this sample weight mechanism. It's discussed on Piazza, so you can probably find it if you go through the through text regarding how to this assignment. But generally, when you train, you can specify the inputs, you can specify the outputs, and you can also specify like the weights for the individual losses. So specifically here, you can say that each example has an array of loss weights, which will be zero for all the bounding boxes which you don't want to predict. So it will not influence the loss at all. And you can add ones for all the bounding boxes where something interesting is happening. Then the individual losses will be multiplied by these weights. Only this one will survive, so that the regression head will only train on this one example, or on as many examples as there are gold objects. And of course, this mass can be obtained from these classes by saying, okay, keep zeros, and whenever there is not zero, we will create one. Right, and you can do this when preparing the data set. So then the element in the TF data data set is a triple: input, output, and sample weights. So there is a question: why do we need to find anchors on the output of the efficient net? I'm not really sure how exactly you mean it, but we need to have this net. Like, what the network does is that it predicts some number of outputs for each of the position in the image, and we need to have an anchor which corresponds, or we need to be able to compute an anchor which would correspond to some specific output of the network. So the network don't really generate such a nice list, but it generates something like a 2D output, right, with some number of channels. And what we need to know is we need to know, okay, this second output, for example, that corresponds to this specific anchor. So we need a mapping which tells us which position in this classification head and in the bounding box regression head corresponds to which anchor. These anchors we use in two places. First, we pass them to bounding box training, right, when we generate the the training data, but we also need them during inference. During inference, we get these outputs, and the network will predict some objects. So the inference is still a bit tricky, right? During inference, we get for all the anchors information whether the anchor contains some object or not. Specifically for each anchor, we have a list of probabilities, whether it's a cat A, cat B, cat C, or dog or something. So if all these values are less than some small constant, 0.05 is being used in RetinaNet, but you can use any other if you want to. For these, we know that there is no gold object attached to this anchor, but if one of those numbers is larger than 0.05, we take the index of the largest and use that as the prediction. So if we get some anchors which are classified to contain an object, we need to compute their bounding boxes. Right. For that, we take the output from the bounding box regressor head. But that's relative to the corresponding anchor. And so this is the second place where we need the anchors, because then during the coding of the bounding boxes, we need to pass the suitable anchor to the corresponding output, which will get us a real bounding box in the coordinates of the original image. So for this, we need anchors. And now we still need to run non-maximum suppression, because it can easily happen that we have predicted the same digit multiple times. So what we need to do is we need to ignore some of the bounding boxes if they overlap with another bounding box of the same class and they have smaller probability, right? So we only keep the best prediction for each object. For that, we can use the existing methods. Luckily, there are ones. So for example, there is TF image non-max suppression. The TF image non-max suppression can be run on, can be run only on a single image, right? So it's not like a batch version. And what do you give it? You give it the set of boxes, like bounding boxes, right, which are represented in this four tuple, which is exactly the four tuple which we use inside our representation. Scores, which are the scores of the generated, scores of these objects. Then we define what is the maximum number of objects in the output. And there is this IOU threshold. And this IOU threshold means that run the non-maximum suppression when the intersection over union is, between two objects is at least this 0.5. And then we also have a score threshold. The score threshold means that we actually don't consider any boxes which score is lower than the threshold. So this threshold, that's this 0.05, actually, right? So what we can do is we can like find the most probable score for each anchor. We might actually to compute the bounding boxes for all possible anchors. We don't need to select beforehand which one we are going to use. We'll just compute all of them, right? And then we can run this non-maximum suppression. It will deal with ignoring the predictions which have too low probability. It will cancel out the predictions which overlap, and we will just get the results. And the results are the indices of the selected boxes. And then once we have them, we know that we can generate them on the output, we can print the bounding boxes, we can print the chosen classes and be done with it. So this is the easier method to use, but we need to process the example sequentially, but it's only during inference. So it's perfectly fine for the assignment. However, if you want to have a more performant solution, there is like a more advanced version, combined non-max suppression, which can be used for for predicting inputs over the batch. So the bounding box is actually a bounding box of bounding boxes. Even like thinks about that there might be various classes, so the scores are actually the individual probabilities of the classes, and you will get everything on the output. So this is able to process the whole batch at once, but you need to generate outputs of different sizes, and they don't use rect tensors yet, then it's slightly more technical, but both of these approaches will work. And once you have done it, you can print the outputs onto the output file and get a green thumb in RecordX. So I don't know if I understand, if I answered your question regarding the anchors. So if you have further one, don't hesitate to ask. Definitely. Mm-hmm. 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 No, these anchors, this anchor net, that needs to be always fixed, right? Because the network generates output relatively to these anchors. So the network doesn't really know concretely about the anchors. It just knows that when it generates some object at this position, it needs to explain, or it needs to describe its coordinate relative to the anchor. So it doesn't really understand that the anchor is there. It just knows that the small objects should be generated with smaller bounding boxes, and the large boxes with objects with larger bounding boxes. So it like this knowledge is implemented or embedded somehow inside the sorry inside the classification head, which is, I don't know where. Oh, it's here. So this knowledge is somehow embedded inside here, inside this blue part. Right. So even if these specific anchor positions are not known to the network, the network knows, like intuitively, that it needs to generate the predictions relative to these anchors. So the anchors cannot really change. Well, this 256, these are just channels. The rest, this is the class, but this is the classes times the number of anchors on each position, right? So in theory, you could have multiple anchors for each position. They have nine, right? Because they have various aspect ratios and various sizes. But in our simple solution, we have only a single anchor for each position. So then, as you say, in our simple solution, this K is, so this A is one. What, just one anchor per center. So it would be just as many numbers as we have classes in the simple solution. Well, we have one anchor for each pixel on this level. Right, so on this level, the image would be, I don't know, something like 40 times 40 or 20 times 20 or something. So for each of these pixels, which in fact corresponds to some non-trivial regions in the original image, we have a single anchor, or technically we have eight anchors, but in the simplest case, just one. So we definitely put the anchors everywhere on in the representation. Yes, for each anchor. Will be. Yes, exactly. And we use the, yes. Yes, these are two outputs. Yeah, so this is not actually an output. Like, this is the description of the data set examples. So this is actually the image, right? This is the true output, Y true, which in fact is a pair of these two things which we are talking about, the classes and the B boxes, right? That's what we generate using B boxes training. And then we have this third element. And this third element is an optional one. We haven't seen it before this assignment. And what it does is that it can contains weights for the losses of the individual examples. And then when we compute the loss, we compute the individual losses for the individual examples. Multiply them by these weights and sum them only after this multiplication. So when we sum the losses, it's actually a weighted sum using these weights. And what we, because when we say class, then for a single image, this class is in fact like a one-dimensional tensor, which will have the size of height times width times the number of anchors times the number of classes. And so this is like a linearized version of this output. And for the B box, we do the same. We have got width times height times times 4, and I'm sorry, I said it's linearized, but it doesn't need to be linearized. You can even make it really like a two-dimensional structure. It's up to you. But what is important is that you don't want to train all these bounding boxes. Some of them you want to ignore during training. So what you need to do is you need to get, you need to somehow instruct the network that, I don't know, if I imagine that I have got these four tuples like standing there inside the vector, that some of them I want to train, maybe this one, and the rest I don't want to train. So I will do that by using these weights, which will be zero everywhere else, then on the anchors for which we actually want to train the B-box, because it contains a gold object. So this third output is a batch of these weights. So we don't need the weights for the classes because we train everywhere, but we need them for these B-boxes. So we will, well, you generate them from bounding box training, like because a bounding box training tells you which of these anchors actually correspond to some object by saying that this class is non-zero. So the easiest thing is to say, okay, that's exactly the mask I need. So for the classes which are non-zero, I will train the bounding box regressor. Well, the weight can be anything. So it can be anything between zero and one. In this case, this zero and one have a reasonable sense that you either don't want to train the bounding box or you want to train it. But there are other possibilities, but I don't think it makes sense to do something between zero and one in this case. But in theory, you could. Like TensorFlow doesn't care, it just multiplies them. Yes, you could. You could set them. You could set them also for the classes. Maybe you could set them somehow correspondingly to the intersection over union. Like maybe if you see the large object, you like want to really predict it there, and the smaller the intersection union over union is, the smaller the white might be. That's all possibilities. Usually people don't really do it. I don't know whether somebody would do it, and if I like know, I just people use zeros and ones. But in theory, you could. Because they, well, In reality, this is usually implemented, or this like in the most complex case, this is implemented really dynamically. So depending on the size of the input image, you get different number of output classes and the different number of bounding boxes. So it's possible to do it, but it's definitely much more complicated. So for our simple data set, I would really have fixed in size inputs and fixed size outputs, but it is possible to keep these width and high height and width dynamics. It is doable, but it's much more complex. Then you need to deal with the fact that the different images in the batch have different size, so you need to pad them somehow. It's really a lot of work, but it's doable if you really want to be able to process even large and even smaller images, then you can. But I wouldn't. Yeah, you're welcome. Great, thanks. There is a question in the chat whether we need to use subclassing if we need to use the non-max suppression. Well, it's not really. It's not really necessary. So, for example, I use the functional approach and still use the non-max suppression. And the thing is, the non-max suppression doesn't need to be in the graph, right? So my model always returns just these two outputs. So it always generates just the probability of the classes and the bounding boxes. So I just use the network.predict batch or predict on batch on the batch, and they I just get them outside of the computation graph, and then I just do the computation in TensorFlow and run the non-max suppression later, really like individually after the prediction, right? So the model can still be a functional model because you are doing this manually in Eager. Well, the scores are the probabilities generated by the classes, right? The classes are in fact the probabilities, like I made it a bit simpler, but what it does is that for each anchor, you have a vector of probabilities, right? There are like k of them if we have got k classes. So I've got k numbers in the classification and four numbers in the bounding box regressor, which corresponds to the fact that you just generate like a convolution with k channels here and the convolution with four channels here. Then here you apply sigmoid, right? Because you want these to be probabilities, and you use the focal loss in this situation where it's like a lot of sigmoids. And then this is what you generate outside of the network. And this is exactly what's called scores in the API. In one of the APIs, they only want a single score, which means you would take the maximum one, right? But the non-combined, the non-max suppression just want one score, right? Score for a single box, which means you would just find the maximum. The combined non-max suppression can take a score, which is batch size, number of boxes, and number of classes. So here you would just exactly put this output as the scores here, right? And the boxes need to be batch size, number of boxes. That's what I have the W, H, and A here. And then four. And then you might have different boxes for different classes, but we won't do that. So you would need to make Q equal to one. All right. They also say, okay, you can do it. And if you have Q equal to one, then the same boxes will be used for all the classes. Yes. Yes. So in fact, we only will have one input. But this is connected to the fact that when using EfficientNet, so what people did is that sometimes they just like they used the EfficientNet.input 0, something like this, I don't remember, something as the input. And when they constructed the model, they say TF Keras model, and the input was just the EfficientNet inputs like this. Right, and then like in the definition of the computation graph, they just used the outputs of the efficient net. But this is not the only way how you can use it. You can also use, or maybe I will need TensorFlow. You can also like explicitly create an input or multiple inputs if you want. So images is TF Keras input, and now I will specify the shape here. I think they won't be happy. So some shape here. And now when I have the efficient net, then I can just like really call it on the images and get the outputs. Right. So if I had multiple inputs, I would define each input using the TF Keras input, and then pass the one of them to the efficient net as if it was a layer, because it is also a layer, and I will get the output. I could process the other inputs by some different ways, and then finally, when defining the model, I would just say, okay, we use the TF Keras model. The inputs are my inputs. Maybe it's a dictionary of inputs, whatever, and the same thing for outputs and so on. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Like this is these are our image inputs. We pass them to the efficient net. So we immediately like get to this. I don't know if I will find it. These are the images, then these blue bars are the efficient net, and the efficient net will give us like multiple of these layers. And in the simplest case, we will choose one of them, right? It cannot be too low and it cannot be too high because both of these extremes won't be great. Because if we take too high resolution, like we only have local information and we will have a lot of anchors. So we are recognizing like two small images, while if we go too high and the resulting representation is like too global, it has too local information, then it recognizes probably very large images, because the corresponding anchors, there won't be that many anchors, right? So you need to choose which level of the efficient that you want actually to use, so that it will reasonably match the density of the gold objects, so that the anchors which you will represent will match the size of the anchors which you want. This is, of course, difficult, and if you have very large and very small objects, it's not solvable, and that's why this feature pyramid network is being used and why the prediction is done on multiple levels. But in our, like, in order to pass the baseline, it is definitely enough just to use a single level. I used a single level and got to something like 40 or something. So you don't need to deal with that, because generally when you look at it, we don't have that much varied sizes, right? Generally the numbers are like at least half of the height of the image, and the width is at least. There are some exceptions, but many of them have like comparable sizes. So choosing one suitable layer is doable. You will probably need to fine tune the efficient net as well, similarly to what we did in the text segmentation, but you should start by only training the rest of the neural network, only the classifiers. And it should train and it should do something. It will probably get even over the 20, or you can get 10 average IOU or something. And once you are there, you know that you also need to fine tune the efficient media during the training, but that will be straightforward at that moment. Well, the anchors, they don't physically exist anywhere, so it's fine if the anchor technically goes out of the image, because we use the anchor only to represent the gold object. So if there would be like a one here, which would be assigned to this anchor, then the only way how we use the anchor is to like have relative coordinates of this bounding box. So we would say, okay, the center is here. So the center is like, I don't know, 0.25, right? Because it's half here. Then the like that's the x coordinate of the center, y coordinate of the center is 0.5 because it's nearly at the bottom of the anchor, and the width and the height is something. So we only use the anchor just to compute the representation or relativize the representation of the bounding box. So it's fine if it's out of the image. It just means that the intersection of reunion with many of the gold objects will be low, and so probably it might not be selected as the referenced object. But it, we don't really fill it with anything or something. We just use it to like compute the representation of the bounding boxes, then extract it out of that, and to assign gold objects to the anchors. And all that is just the virtual operations. You're welcome. Yep. Yeah, well, like generally the most advanced things which are done, first like generate these bounding boxes. So they in fact run this overall pipeline. So you get like really bounding boxes with the objects. And then you run segmentation, but not the segmentation on the overall image as we have done it, but segmentation on this bounding box, right? So if there are multiple objects, you get bounding boxes for them. And then this segmentation thing runs not over the whole image, but just inside this bounding box. From this point of view, our segmentation assignment was very simple, even if it may not have looked like that, because we just segmented the pixels of the original image. And it generates, it recognizes multiple objects. Of the boxes and the classifications. Mm-hmm. And now, this might not be enough information. So maybe you would also want to know where the objects actually are inside these bounding boxes. So then you could also have another output, third output, which would be like a segmentation inside these bounding boxes. So you would know where exactly in these bounding boxes the objects actually are, right? That's what the mask RCNN does. Another overall picture? No. So, yeah, from the presentation. So that will be the something like this. Yes, so that's what this image shows, that here there are this class and bounding box subnet, and so you can add a third branch, which apart from the classes and the bounding boxes also generates the segmentation masks, but for the recognized objects, right? So you don't do it in the original image, you do it for the bounding boxes. Yeah, much more better results. These, like, let's do it separately. People were doing it, like the original RCNN, not the fast RCN, but just the RCNN did things like that. That really, like, cut out the regions of the original image and then process them independently. But one of the problems is that it's extremely slow. With the current networks, like, either you need to train. Like, it doesn't really make sense to do it independently. So people are using this common convolution at the beginning to really, like, reuse the networks which we have. Like, if you want these things to be reasonably fast, then these single stage detectors, they evaluate something like 10,000 positions in every image. So processing each of them independently would be really undoable. While like computing the representation for all of these at the same time is definitely much more manageable. And as far as we know, the best architectures do it like this. Maybe one of the reasons that nobody is actually able to train architectures which would independently classify 10,000 images. But the thing is, now when you have the representation of one area actually contains some information about also the neighboring one. So if you just cut out the images, they are too small. Like, all the features depend only on this cut out part of the image. But maybe, like, understanding what's happening outside of this region is also useful, right? So that you know that, well, on this image, it's not obvious whether this black spot is a part of the dog or not. But if you have the whole image, then you might understand that it's actually a part of the motorbike, but it's not seen on this box. By the way, I probably never showed you. Sorry. So I think at this point we can stop the recording.